You know, when we think about it, our way shower Jesus was absolutely the most perfect teacher. He was able to take deep spiritual truths and translate them in simple language. He used wonderfully practical parables, just meaningful metaphors, and just all this symbolic and yet meaningful language to his audience. And let's think of largely who his audience consisted of. His audience consisted of simple, uneducated farmers, fishermen, the poor peasants of the area. And they were able to listen to his words and really understand these deep spiritual lessons. Was just a powerful teacher. And one of the things that he talked about a lot was the subject of faith. If you remember last week, we looked at that parable where the master goes off and leaves three servants in charge of his talents. And when he returns, he is just delighted with two of his servants who have doubled what he gave them. But he's not so happy with servant number three, who fearfully buried the talent. Remember that? Well, the interesting part of that story that's pertinent to our conversation today is when he complimented and honored the two successful servants, he didn't say a word about their business sense. He didn't talk about what good investors they were. He complimented them on what? Their faith. Their faith. He said, "Your faith. I honor you for your faith. Oh, good and faithful servants," he said. So this issue of faith is important throughout Jesus' teachings. And actually, he really credits often, even in a healing, he credits not himself and not even God, but he credits the faith of the person being healed. Just think of this. To the woman who touched the hem of his garment and was healed, he said to her, "Take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well." And to the Roman soldier who knew Jesus could heal his servant from afar, Jesus said, "Truly, I tell you, not even in all of Israel have I found such faith." And when Jesus healed two men who were blind simply by touching their eyes, he said to them, "According to your faith, let it be done to you." Now, perhaps the best known definition of faith and how it works is from Paul's letter to the Hebrews, chapter 1, verse 1. I'm going to try this one more time, and it is not working. You want to put a new battery in for me? Bob is my Vanna White, and I appreciate him very much. He said, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." The conviction of things not seen? Really? We are supposed to believe in something we cannot even see? That there's no evidence to it, or sometimes even evidence to the contrary right before our eyes? There's a wonderful little story about this in Linda Martella Witsit's book, Divine Audacity. I love this title. I wish I had thought of it. Divine Audacity. The audacity to live from our divine nature. I love it. And anyway, this is a story that I'd like to share with you. Let me find the right place here. Here we go. Okay. All right. Marked. A farming community suffered during a protracted drought. The parched earth produced little of the life and wealth-sustaining crop that every family depended on. A local minister called the community together to pray for rain. The town square became crowded with citizens from all faiths. All the citizens of the town were gathered together. The minister greeted everyone, scanning the crowd for familiar faces. And his eyes suddenly landed way in the back on a little girl, a young girl, approaching from the rear. And first he noticed that everyone in the crowd parted so she could come forward. And then he realized why. The little girl was walking through the aisle that the audience had created, the crowd had created, carrying her umbrella. So that is a really good model, it really is, of what we're talking about today. And if you've been in Unity for very long, you know that we talk a lot about the fact that we are spiritual beings. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience, but we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And because we are made in the image and likeness of God, and God is spirit, well, then obviously we have to be spirit too, in essence. And we are more than our minds. We are more than our bodies. We are spirit, eternal spirit. And living as spiritual beings, having a human experience, in-body experience, we might say, means that with every breath we take, we have the ability to navigate two realms. We can identify with the invisible absolute realm, and at the same time, we can participate in the relative physical realm. Let's see if this works. Sorry. Vanna failed. What can I say? Okay. So, the absolute realm. That is the place where all accords with God as divine principle. It's the unseen realm of divine ideas in all their purity and power. It's pure ideal God and therefore pure ideal good, eternal wholeness, boundless love, perfect life, and overflowing abundance. This is the realm of infinite possibilities. And the relative realm, in which we're all navigating at the moment, we're actually navigating in both at the moment, but the relative realm is our constantly changing outer world, the physical plane. It's what we really take in with our senses, with our eyes and our ears and our other three senses. Now, Jesus taught and demonstrated always that looking beyond what we see with our physical eyes, we can take in greater truths of the spiritual realm. And this is what it means in the Bible verse we're off, oh, there's a relative realm, the physical realm, the outer appearances. And this is what it means when we say, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Walking by faith means that we understand that any existing condition on this plane of existence in our physical lives has the potential to be healed and transformed through the spiritual realm. And the chaplains call this, in the chaplain program, we call this holding spiritual space, holding the space of God in the midst of any earthly challenge, and knowing that that power is greater. So no matter what's occurring in our outer lives, we have the choice and the power to lift our consciousness to the spiritual realm. Now, thank goodness that faith, we're talking about today, is actually a spiritual power, one of our 12 gifts from God, as most of you know, called the 12 Powers by our co-founder, Charles Fillmore. Now, these 12 powers really represent, first of all, the number 12, we need to talk about that. 12 represents spiritual perfection or wholeness. So these 12 powers, sometimes referred to as abilities, or faculties, or gifts, are all aspects of the divine within each one of us. And the more we realize and understand the possibility and the presence of these 12 gifts, the more we align ourselves with the creative power of spirit. Symbolized by the 12 disciples, they are evolved through the guidance and directions of the Christ. And each actually expresses in a particular body center, which we'll talk about in a minute. So, the very first and considered to be the greatest disciple of Jesus called was Peter. And Peter universally, in almost all faiths, represents faith. Charles Fillmore writes, "Faith is the perceiving power of mind linked with the power to shape substance. It's spiritual assurance, the power to do the seemingly impossible, the force that draws our good out of that invisible spiritual realm into manifestation in our lives. Faith is more than believing. It is a deep inner knowing. It is a carrying your umbrella type of faith, knowing that which we seek is already ours for the asking, because God wants for us only our ever unfolding good. So faith is our affirmative power. It's our ability to say yes to good and God, to hold the conviction that unlimited good is being manifested always in our lives. And the power of faith, like the other 12 powers, already exists within us. We don't have to go out and get it. It's here. But it's our job to call it forth. Charles Fillmore used the word quicken, which is kind of an old-fashioned word, meaning to just call upon or recognize, to develop it. And the body center for the power of faith is the pineal gland at the center of the brain. Now, it's really hard to show this in a one-dimensional picture. It's almost impossible because it's really in the center of your brain. But just work through this little exercise with me. If you were to draw an imaginary line between your ears, okay, and cross it with an imaginary line coming from your eyes, where those two lines intersect, in the middle of your brain would be the location of your faith center. And Winifred Houseman, in her book, Your God-Given Potential, Unfolding the 12 Spiritual Powers, we used this as a supplementary book when we did the 12 Powers class a year or so ago. Anyway, she says that this location in the center of our brain is significant. Because when we put faith in what we see with our eyes and what we hear with our ears, we are using the faculty in a limited sensory way. However, when we develop our God-given power of faith through prayer and affirmation, we place our faith in an inner vision and an inner hearing, and we get to decide the direction of our faith. Our souls are pivotal. We can turn it to the outer world, or we can turn it to God and turn it to Spirit. In other words, I can put my faith in a diagnosis or in my innate wholeness. I can put my faith in a dwindling bank account balance or in God's abundance. I can put my faith in discord and conflict. And that's easy to do when we watch the news today, isn't it? It really is. Or I can place my faith in harmony and peace. And at its highest level, faith is directed to our spiritual nature, by our spiritual nature, from the awareness of the Christ of our being. Now, awareness of the Christ is beautifully illustrated in a familiar story that's related in all three Gospels, all three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in today's version, we're going to read from Matthew, and this takes place at the point in Jesus' ministry when he is becoming pretty famous and beginning to draw large crowds, and he and his closest disciples must feel like they need a break. So they take a little short retreat in the city of Caesarea Philippi, and that's where our story begins. Okay. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do the people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others say Jeremiah or one of the prophets. I think I made his name modern there, Jeremy. Jeremiah or one of the prophets. He said to them, "But who do you say I am?" And Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." That's where it takes place, at the very top. Can you see the up at the top here? It's the very northern part of Israel where all the big mountains are. And here's what Peter says: "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answers, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I will tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven." So Jesus is asking his disciples, his closest disciples, "What is the word on the street about me? What are people saying?" And the disciples report, well, some of them say you're John the Baptist, some of them say you might be the reincarnated prophets. But Jesus, the master teacher, knows the art of the follow-up question. And he asks, as we read, but who do you say I am? Now, this I am, I'm going to go back here for a minute. This I am is the name we know that God said, that was his name, as given to Moses on Mount Sinai. He said to Moses, I am that I am. Tell them I am has sent you. And we all use those words, I am, to describe our human identity, don't we? I'll say, I am Jan Morning. You'll say, I am in your name. You might name your profession. You might say, I'm a mother, I'm a father. You know, we use that all the time to identify ourselves in the outer world. But spiritually, I am is the universal name for our spiritual selves as distinguished from our human selves. And to answer Jesus' question, it is Simon who replies, we'll go here again, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. I can just picture these words like flying out of his mouth, like he doesn't even hardly realize they're coming out, while the other disciples are just sort of standing there trying to think of something to say. And Peter certainly may make some mistakes later on. We know he did. But at this moment, in this place, he is the one who recognizes Jesus' true inner essence. And because of this, Jesus sees in Simon the quality of faith, the ability to look beyond what the others see to the greater reality. And Jesus says, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. Flesh and blood metaphysically symbolizes input from our minds, our senses, opinions of others, from the world, all those things that contribute to what we think we know. But all this outer input could never have led to Peter's insight. This realization had to come from within, where the truth always resides. Now, we mentioned last week that name changes in the Bible always represent moving to a higher consciousness, and this is where Jesus renames Simon as Peter. Peter in the early Greek meant stone or rock, and Jesus is saying that faith, this assurance of things not seen, is the underlying rock or foundation of the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven meaning that realm of divine ideas that produce their perfect expression in every single one of us. And Jesus says, upon this rock I will build my church. Now the word church here does not mean what we think of it as today. It does not mean any type of structured religion, or it doesn't even mean a building like this one, as beautiful as it is. Jesus never organized a church on this earth, neither did he authorize anyone else to do so. The word used by Jesus was ecclesia, meaning an aggregation of spiritual ideas or awakened spiritual consciousness. And so the ability to recognize and hold this Christ consciousness is built on the rock of faith. And the phrase, the gates of Hades will not prevail against it, Hades refers in the Greek to outer darkness, the realm of senses only. So Jesus is telling his disciples and us that nothing in the outer realm can diminish or prevail against the light of spirit. Light always overcomes darkness, always. And Jesus knows, he knows that Peter's fault's going to falter, Peter's faith is going to falter. Very shortly after this conversation, when Peter says that Jesus should never be crucified, Jesus calls him a stumbling block, a rock on my path. Another meaning of rock. And yes, we know that Peter's faith vacillated. He even denied Jesus three times near the end. But Peter, like all Bible characters, teaches us something. And maybe what we learn from Peter is about our own developing and sometimes, let's be honest, faltering faith. Faith does not come in a mighty thud. It's a process. It's a lifetime process. And Hausman writes, the power of faith must be encouraged. It must be invited and made welcome. And Simon, the crude fisherman, became Peter, the dedicated apostle. So the ability to trust God must also grow in our lives. There's a wonderful story about Myrtle Fillmore that took place at the Village, and it was at a time when they were in great financial straits. In fact, there was a stack of bills to be paid and no visible money to pay them with, and they couldn't meet the payroll. So Myrtle and Charles invited all of the workers at the Village in, everyone, and they all sat around a huge table, and they came to pray about the situation. And as they gathered to pray, one of the workers said, "Oh, I'm so glad that you called us all together. We're going to pray that the money holds out." And Myrtle, in her typical quiet style, said, "Oh, no, we're going to pray that our faith holds out." And this same struggle, I guess we'd say, with faith, you know, trying to see it when it's trying to see things that aren't there yet, occurs to our disciples a lot as they walk the earth with Jesus. One such incident is recorded again in all three synoptic gospels, and in Matthew's account, this incident happens just after the disciples have tried and failed to heal a young boy with epilepsy. And actually, first Jesus gets mad at them. He says to them, "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring him to me." And then Jesus immediately heals him. So later, after Jesus has calmed down, the disciples go back to him and they say, "Why couldn't we cast it out? Why couldn't we heal this boy?" And he says to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I tell you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." Now, Jesus always spoke in parables, we already said this, and metaphors, but really that didn't start with Jesus. It was a long-standing Hebrew tradition. Jesus just took it to new levels of mastery. And let's think for a minute about the images he uses here. The mustard seed, the smallest of seeds, about the size of a pencil. I thought about bringing some mustard seeds in today, but I didn't want to face cleaning up after them, so I didn't. But anyway, if you picture the end of a pencil point, that's about how big a typical mustard seed is. And the mountain, the huge, mighty mountain. Now, some of the mountains that Jesus' followers knew so well up in the northern area where this takes place, there were gigantic peaks reaching a height of about 10,000 feet. So obviously Jesus is using here the storyteller's tool of hyperbole. He absolutely is not speaking literally, and his disciples would have known it. They were used to this. They would have understood that this mustard seed symbolized a tiny kernel of faith that we need to call forth in the beginning. And also they would have known some things about that minuscule mustard seed that many of us who live in an urban suburban area do not know today. Among them, that a mustard seed is characterized by rapid germination. I love this job. I get to learn so many interesting things. And this is amazing, that a mustard seed planted and with the optimal conditions starts to grow the very next day. It's amazing. You can already see the little sprout. And it sprouts all by itself. It doesn't need any cultivation at all. And it grows to a really large bush, some as tall as 8 feet. There's one that's a human being in front of it. It's a little blurry, but that's a human being. So, knowing this, the disciples would have understood that Jesus is saying just a tiny little seed of faith called forth in us quickly multiplies and expands. And regarding the mountain, we can just picture Jesus and his disciples at the bottom of Mount Hermon, which they have just come back from, just looking up at the mountains. We can just picture that. And Jesus makes here use of a familiar Jewish proverb to teach a deep spiritual truth. Moving a mountain was a common expression in ancient Israel. It's in all the literature. And it referred to something that was absolutely impossible to do or something that was really an extreme challenge. And in fact, there was a phrase they used called "rooter up of mountains," which was a metaphor to describe a great teacher, a rabbi, or a spiritual leader. Someone who was a rooter of mountains was someone who was known for doing the seemingly impossible. And so Jesus tells his disciples and us, say to the problem, the outward condition, the challenge that looms so large in your life, move, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Jesus is saying here that our faith that allows the power of God to work through us and achieve all we want to achieve is our spiritual power. Not only faith in the power and presence of God, I think most of us have that, but also faith in ourselves. Bible scholar Ed Townley suggests that the disciples could not heal the young man with epilepsy because they did not have enough faith in themselves as healers. And I agree with that. And so it is with us. We need to have faith in ourselves, in our innate oneness, and in the power of God in order to engage in healing of any kind. So really, to take this lesson of faith into our hearts, maybe we need to follow Jesus' example and have some follow-up questions. So here they are. What are your mountains? What are your life challenges that seem so large and so looming? Do they include a diagnosis of an illness, yourself or another loved one? Financial problems? Discord in some area of your life? A problem in a relationship? Fear of the future, something from your past that you seem unable to let go? And once you've identified your mountain, just know that you have within you the God-given gift of the power of faith, mountain-moving faith. Mountain-moving faith is the ability to sweep away, to get rid of, the negative appearances, to use your spiritual vision to see the good, even if it's not yet manifesting in your life. Mountain-moving faith is the ability to look beyond appearances and know that any problem in the physical realm has the potential to be healed and transformed. Muhammad Gandhi said, "It is faith that steers us through stormy seas, faith that moves mountains, faith that jumps across the ocean. That faith is nothing but a living, wide awake consciousness of God within." And so mountain moving faith is the sure and certain knowing that through the power of God, all things are possible. Mountain moving faith is a spiritual power that we all possess. Quicken your power of faith. Call it forth, develop it, and as Jesus taught, all things will be possible for you. So let's take a moment to take this power and presence of God, this concept of our God, into our hearts as we prepare for our time of prayer and meditation. Let's affirm, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.